I'm Amy Goodman. In this age of climate chaos and COVID-19, you count on Democracy Now! To stay focused on the issues that matter most. We count on you to support our independent journalism. If everyone who tunes into Democracy Now! Gave just $4, we could cover our operating costs for 2022. Really, that's all it would take. Please do your part today by visiting us at democracynow.org. Oh, and stay safe, wear a mask, save lives. Thank you so much, and happy holidays. From New York, this is Democracy Now!
We just wanted accountability because we can never have justice because we can never get George back.
Former Minneapolis police officer Derek Chauvin has switched his plea to guilty of violating George Floyd's civil rights, marking the first time he's publicly admitted to his role in Floyd's death. We'll speak with civil rights lawyer Ben Crump about why and get an update on the manslaughter trial of former police officer Kimberly Potter, charged with killing motorist Dante Wright in a Minneapolis suburb when she says she mistook her gun for a taser. Then, the trailblazing black feminist scholar and activist Bell Hooks died Wednesday at 69.
To talk about how I became Bell Hooks, renowned writer and intellectual, how I survived the racist, sexist, class, elitism outside the home of my growing up, and the dysfunction which sanctioned abuse, betrayal, and abandonment within the patriarchal home. I talk about the significance of critical thinking.
We'll hear Bell Hooks in her own words and talk about her work fighting what she called the imperialist, white supremacist, capitalist patriarchy. We'll speak with her close friend, Beverly Guy Sheftall, former president of the National Women's Studies Association and professor of women's studies at Spelman College. Then Democratic Senator Raphael Warnock calls from the Senate floor for the conservative members of the Democratic Party to stop obstructing voting rights legislation and support ending the filibuster.
So when colleagues in this chamber talk to me about bipartisanship, which I believe in, I just have to ask at whose expense? Who is being asked to foot the bill for this bipartisanship? And is liberty itself the cost?
All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. President Biden warned Thursday of an imminent surge of COVID-19 cases as the Omicron coronavirus variant continues to spread around the world and across the U.S. at an unprecedented pace.
For unvaccinated, we are looking at a winter of severe illness and death for unvaccinated, for themselves, their families, and the hospitals they'll soon overwhelm.
U.S. COVID-19 hospitalizations continue to rise, with nearly 1,300 people dying of the disease each day in the United States. Amidst the surge, many prominent universities, including NYU, DePaul, and Princeton, have returned to online classes. Cornell University canceled most campus activities after 1,100 students tested positive for coronavirus in just 1 week. The NFL, the National Football League, and the NBA, the National Basketball Association, have announced new COVID-19 protocols after dozens of players tested positive this week. Here in New York City, Mayor Bill de Blasio has announced plans to distribute 1 million high-quality masks and 500,000 at-home COVID-19 tests. The Centers for Disease Control said Thursday people should avoid use of Johnson & Johnson's COVID-19 vaccine and should instead opt for vaccines produced by Pfizer and Moderna. A vaccine advisory panel cited the risk of extremely rare but life-threatening blood clots linked to J&J shots. Meanwhile, the American Civil Liberties Union warns Immigration and Customs Enforcement is denying COVID booster shots to some 21,000 prisoners being held in ICE jails around the U.S. An ACLU attorney said, quote, "This is yet another example of ICE's cavalier approach to the health and safety of people in detention in violation of their constitutional rights and underscores the inherent danger of detention in the first place, they said. The Food and Drug Administration has permanently removed the in-person restriction on accessing abortion pills, allowing patients to receive the medication by mail after a telehealth consultation. Previously, pregnant people had to go to an on-site provider to take the prescription drug, though that requirement was lifted during the pandemic. The medication, mifepristone, was approved by the FDA in 2000 and has become an increasingly popular method of abortion. It's used in conjunction with the drug misoprostol. Reproductive rights advocates hailed the FDA decision at a time when the fate of Roe v. Wade hangs in the balance with a conservative majority Supreme Court. A federal judge has thrown out a roughly $4.5 billion settlement with Purdue Pharma that shielded the Sackler family from future lawsuits. Judge Colleen McMahon of the Southern District of New York ruled the bankruptcy court does not have the authority to grant the Sacklers such legal protection. The Sacklers have refused to acknowledge any personal responsibility in the deadly opioid crisis. In Chile, the widow of former U.S.-backed dictator Augusto Pinochet has died at the age of 99. Lucia Iriarte married General Pinochet in 1943 and stood by him as he toppled the democratically elected President Salvador Allende in a bloody 1973 coup supported by the Nixon administration. During Pinochet's 17-year reign, more than 3,000 Chileans were murdered and disappeared. Tens of thousands more were tortured. Iriarte's death was announced just days before Sunday's presidential election, pitting far-right candidate José Antonio Kast against leftist Gabriel Boric, a former student leader. In Santiago, large crowds gathered to celebrate news of Iriarte's passing.
For now, all I can feel is joy, but also anger because she died without paying for her crimes. But there's hope with Gabriel Boric's candidacy for the presidency, for a fair presidency that is full of love and justice. We can return to having a country we can all love that was taken from us 30 years ago.
Super Typhoon Rai struck the southeastern Philippines Thursday with winds topping 160 miles per hour. At least seven deaths have been reported. Nearly 100,000 people evacuated ahead of landfall. The typhoon is the third Category 5 storm to make landfall in the Philippines in the past 2 years. In Kentucky, workers who survived the tornado that flattened a candle factory in the city of Mayfield last week have sued their employer, charging Mayfield Consumer Products with flagrant indifference that led to the deaths of eight people. The lawsuit alleges managers had up to 3.5 hours to evacuate the factory amid reports of approaching severe weather, but instead chose to threaten workers with termination if they left their shifts early. A union representing 1,400 Kellogg's workers has reached a tentative agreement with the cereal giant on a new 5-year contract. If approved by workers during a weekend vote, the deal will end a more than 2-month strike at 4 Kellogg's plants. A previous tentative agreement that would have brought 3% raises was rejected by an overwhelming majority of workers. In Massachusetts, workers at 2 Boston-area Starbucks stores have announced a unionization effort. Their campaign comes after workers at a Buffalo Starbucks location voted last week to form the first U.S.-based union at Starbucks. In Los Angeles County, workers at a cake factory that produces desserts for chain stores, including Walmart and Baskin-Robbins, are on a day 45 of a strike demanding better working conditions. The mostly Latinx immigrant workers say they're forced to work up to 15 hours a day, have to produce 13 cakes per minute, and are granted only 3 sick days a year. The Senate parliamentarian has rejected Democrats' third bid to include immigration reform in the Build Back Better bill. The proposal included granting work permits and deportation protections to millions of people. The news prompted a swift rebuke from immigrant justice advocates and Democratic lawmakers. New York Congressmember Jamal Bowman tweeted, quote, "The parliamentarian is not an elected official. Their guidance is advisory, not law. The Republicans have fired the parliamentarian to pass their tax cuts for the wealthy. Democrats must overrule the parliamentarian to pass immigration reform," he said. Axios is reporting the Biden administration has stopped holding undocumented families in detention centers, relying instead on electronic ankle bracelets and other tracking methods. The administration's not announced an official policy ending the harmful practice, and facilities are still holding adults in often inhumane conditions. Immigrant rights advocates have also condemned the intense surveillance of migrants and likened monitoring devices to shackles. In related news, the Justice Department has pulled out of talks to compensate migrant families who are separated at the border under Trump's zero-tolerance policy. Over 5,000 children, including babies, were ripped from their families, which Biden has called a moral and national shame. But last month, Biden rejected reports his administration could offer up to $450,000 per family, saying, quote, that's not going to happen. Haitian officials announced Thursday the remaining 12 North American missionaries who were kidnapped in October have been released. Five others had previously been freed. The Gang 400 Mawozo had initially demanded a ransom of $1 million for each of the 17 hostages. It's not been confirmed whether any money was exchanged for the release, though one source said a smaller amount was paid to the gang, but not by the U.S. government. Jean Montreville, the immigrant activist and former U.S. permanent resident who was abruptly deported to Haiti in 2018, has been given 3 years of deferred action that will allow him to remain in the United States to pursue a path to permanent status. This comes as a result of a settlement in his First Amendment lawsuit against the U.S. government. Montreville argued federal immigration officials targeted him for his activism, including his criticism of the Trump administration's policies towards Haiti. We'll speak with Jean Montreville and his lawyer on Monday. You can see more than a decade of our interviews with him at our website, democracynow.org. And in Buenos Aires, Argentina, representative of Burma's Rohingya Muslim minority testified in court Thursday as a trial got underway against senior Burmese military officials, charging them with crimes against humanity. The case was brought under the principle of universal jurisdiction, which allows for serious international crimes to be prosecuted even if they were committed in another nation. First to testify was activist Mong Tun Kin, one of an estimated 730,000 Rohingya Muslims who fled Burma after a military-led crackdown in 2017.
My brothers and sisters were brutally killed and murdered by Burmese military, and thousands of our sisters were raped by Burmese military. I'm a victim. I'm a genocide survivor. Many genocide survivors, we want to get justice. So we are seeking justice as under universal jurisdiction case.
And those are some of the headlines. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. We begin today's show in Minnesota, where former police officer Derek Chauvin pleaded guilty Wednesday to a federal charge of violating George Floyd's civil rights. Chauvin had previously pleaded not guilty, but changed his plea after he was found guilty of Floyd's murder in a closely watched trial. This was the first time Chauvin publicly admitted to his role in Floyd's death. George Floyd's family held a news conference following Chauvin's hearing. This is one of Floyd's brothers, Philonise Floyd, speaking outside the federal court in St. Paul, Minnesota.
We just wanted accountability because we can never have justice because we can never get George back. We can never heal, but we can just be a big family that we always have been. We always been together. The same thing we did with George. We still do it. Just like me, when I want to feel like I'm closer to George, I always eat me a banana mayonnaise sandwich because that's something that we did together. And watching sports and different things and praying, I think about George all the time.
As part of Derek Chauvin's plea deal, he'll also plead guilty to violating the civil rights of a black 14-year-old during his 2017 arrest. Chauvin grabbed the teen by the throat, hit him repeatedly in the head with a flashlight, and pressed his knee into the boy's neck while he was prone, handcuffed, and not resisting. The teen, who's not been identified, was present in the courtroom Wednesday. According to the Pool reporter inside court, Philonise Floyd turned to the teen after Chauvin's hearing and said, quote, it's a good day for justice. This is George Floyd's nephew, Brandon Williams, speaking at the Floyd Family News Conference Wednesday.
We were in court with a minor who he also pled guilty to charges of assault to him. And after hearing the details of it, that guy's a monster. He should have been arrested in 2017 and had justice and Had he been held accountable for what he did in 2017 to that minor, George Floyd would still be here. He knew what he was doing. He had 9 minutes and 29 seconds to understand what he was doing and stop kneeling. He chose not to.
Derek Chauvin is currently serving a 22-and-a-half-year prison sentence after being convicted on all three counts, including unintentional second-degree murder for killing George Floyd by kneeling on his neck for 9 minutes and 29 seconds in May 2020. Chauvin was the first white police officer in Minnesota to ever be convicted of killing a black man. Well, for more, we're joined in Orlando, Florida, by civil rights attorney Ben Crump. He's part of George Floyd's family's legal team. Welcome back to Democracy Now, Ben Crump. Can you start off by talking about the significance of Chauvin changing his plea to guilty and what this means for him?
It's very significant. In fact, everything about the tragic killing of George Floyd and the aftermath as we pursue equal justice in America is historic. The fact that you have a white police officer not only being convicted on the state level for killing a black man in America, but now you have that officer being convicted based on his plea of guilty on the federal level. It is very landmark as we think about the history of police excessive force on black people in America. Rarely are they held accountable at all, but to be held accountable on both levels, on state level and federal level, we believe sends a very clear message that the deliberate indifference and the denial of constitutional rights of marginalized people of color won't be tolerated. And it is very important that in George Floyd's case, this tragedy that was seen by millions upon millions of people all around the world, that the message for our children, for our young people, is that this is unacceptable.
And can you talk about the 17-year-old and how can you talk about the 17-year-old and how significant it is that if Derek Chauvin had been brought up on charges in 2017, that as his nephew pointed out, George Floyd would be alive today? What happened to the teenager?
Well, absolutely. This teenager, this 17-year-old black teenager, was brutalized very similar to George Floyd. This whole notion of putting a knee on the back of a person, on the neck of a person who is not resisting, and it is something that we believe the Minneapolis Police Department and especially union leaders had condoned. This idea of killology is the term they use, Amy, and it was to brutalize people and, in fact, to take control of a person, even if that meant killing them for unjustifiable reasons. It was a culture. It was a mentality. And had they dealt with this with the 17-year-old unidentified black teenager in 2017, as Brandon Williams, George Floyd's nephew, said, this police officer who was without morals, without ethics, would have never put his knee on George Floyd's neck for 9 minutes and 29 seconds, because he would have already been held accountable for doing a similar act to a 17-year-old kid. And maybe that's why he was so cool and collected while he sat there with his knee on George Floyd's neck and his hand in his pocket, because he knew, based on what happened in 2017, nothing was going to happen. And so he had no care about George Floyd's pleas saying, "I can't breathe," 28 times.
And what about the other three officers? When are they being tried?
It is scheduled in late January for their trials to commence. We believe that the plea of Derek Chauvin and the detail, the great detail that he admitted to in his plea is going to help make sure there's accountability for those three officers' role in killing of George Floyd.
I want to go on to another case and then another one. I want to ask you about the Minnesota manslaughter trial of former Brooklyn Center police officer Kimberly Potter. Local media reports Potter is expected to take the stand in her own defense today on the eighth day of testimony. The white woman is charged with first-degree and second-degree manslaughter in the killing of 20-year-old black motorist Dante Wright during a minor traffic stop in April. Body cam video showed Potter pointing her 9mm pistol at Wright, repeatedly shouting "taser" before firing a single bullet into Wright's chest. Potter claimed she drew the pistol by mistake. She's a 26-year-old police veteran who was training other officers when she shot Wright. Just before Dante was killed, he called his mother to say he was being pulled over, allegedly because an air freshener was obscuring his rearview mirror and for an expired registration tab. Katie Bryant, Wright's mom, testified about this phone call in Kim Potter's trial last week. She was the prosecution's first witness.
He just sounded really nervous, but I reassured him that it would be okay.
The call ended. Katie Bryant later made a video call. A woman, likely Dante Wright's partner, Elena Albrecht Payton, who was in the car at the time of his killing, answered the phone.
She said that they shot him. And she faced the phone towards the driver's seat. And my son was laying there. He was unresponsive, and he looked dead.
In the end, they ended up handcuffing Dante Wright's partner. The prosecution rested its case Thursday. One of its witnesses, Minnesota State Investigator Sam McGinnis, testified this week that Potter failed to test her taser as required on the day she fatally shot Wright. He also laid out the differences between a Glock pistol and a taser.
The taser is yellow. The firearm is black. The taser has a stocky body to it compared to the Glock handgun. The grip of the taser is shorter and wider than the Glock.
Meanwhile, Wednesday, use of force expert Seth Stoughton testified for the prosecution that Potter acted unreasonably in shooting Wright. He said, quote, "The use of deadly force was not appropriate. The evidence suggests a reasonable officer in Officer Potter's position could not have believed it was proportional to the threat at the time," he said. Stoughton's a professor at University of South Carolina School of Law, who also testified for the prosecution at Chauvin's trial. Ben Crump, your response to Kim Potter's trial so far, what do you expect the outcome to be? You're Dante Wright's family's attorney.
We expect that there will be accountability for another unjustified death of another young black man. When you think about this excuse that it was an innocent mistake, it wasn't innocent at all for her and the police officers to yet again have a pretextual stop of a minority in Minneapolis. We know that these pretextual stops, whether you say it's a air freshener obscuring a view of the driver, whether you say it's an expired registration, during the pandemic where they have been given memos that they should not be stopping motorists for expired license plates because they were closed, which leads to them engaging in the most use of force. She should be found guilty for two reasons, because they were violations of policy, irrespective of her plea that it was an innocent mistake. Number one, you never should have violated your policy and used the taser for a traffic stop. And they tried to offer this justification that, oh, she feared it was a life or death situation. But when we look at the video, we must remember never was anybody in a life or death situation based on what we can see with our eyes. And everything that Dante Wright was accused of was a misdemeanor. So black people should not be killed in America over misdemeanor pretextual traffic stops. Secondly, when she employed the taser, she aimed it at his chest. That, again, was a violation of the policies of the Brooklyn Center Police Department. So she should be convicted on manslaughter because she was reckless, she was flagrant, and she was reckless in following the policies that she had been trained on for 26 years. She was the training officer teaching rookie cops on how to interact with citizens, and there cannot be a different standard for when they interact with white citizens versus black citizens. We just had the guilty verdict and the plea in Derek Chauvin's case, and I expect we should get a guilty verdict in Kim Potter's case. But I will say this. These are great victories in the interest of justice, but at what cost? George Floyd and Dante Wright should be living today, enjoying the holidays with their families. These young black fathers have been taken from their children unjustly and unconstitutionally and unnecessarily.
And I just wanted to clarify, as you said, Kim Potter is a 26-year veteran, not 26-year-old police veteran. And she was training two other officers on the scene. It so much reminds me of the Philando Castile case, because you have a man who is stopped. I mean, remember, in this case, when we talk about air freshener hanging from there, it's those little Christmas tree-like air fresheners. That's the kind of thing that we're talking about that so many people have. But Philando Castile, who shot and his girlfriend, his partner, films him dying, and she ultimately is arrested, just as the partner of Dante Wright is arrested. They spend more time arresting her than helping him.
Yeah, and that's the tragic circumstance. It seems to be that black lives don't matter in the moments when they are trying to justify killing another black person, and you just see them start to conspire to try to cover up something they know is wrong. We have to continue to shine a light on this, because it's happening far too often. Even in the aftermath of George Floyd, we continue to see these unjust killings all over America of unarmed black people.
Ben Crump, I wanted to also ask you about the case of Javier Ambler. The county of Williamson, Texas, has announced a settlement of $5 million in his 2019 wrongful death. The 40-year-old black man died after being repeatedly tasered by police during a traffic stop. Police body cam footage released last year showed Ambler telling officers, "I have congestive heart failure, I can't breathe," as they continued to tase him. And a warning to our audience, the following footage contains graphic police violence.
Other hand, put it out there. Other hand, give me your hand. I'm gonna lay flat on your stomach. 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 Stop resisting. Stop resisting. Stop resisting.
You can hear Javier saying, "I am not resisting." The reality TV show Live PD caught the killing on camera, but later destroyed the footage. Live PD, as well as the similar show Cops, went on to get canceled following public outrage over their glorification of police brutality. Details about Javier Ambler's death only came to light after the Austin American-Statesman successfully forced the release of the police body cam footage and internal reports about the killing. If you can comment on this case, who has been arrested? Who has been charged?
At this time, the only announcement is that a civil settlement has been reached with the family of Javier Ambler. The criminal justice system in America, as we know, continues to move slowly in our demands for justice. The question that the family has, as many citizens, is why don't police believe black men when they say, I can't breathe? Why is it always met with further torture? And so we pray that the settlement and the passage of important legislation in the aftermath of the death of Javier Ambler will lead to preventing future deaths of unarmed people who are needlessly and unjustifiably, again, stopped for pretextual traffic stops.
Finally, the George Floyd Justice in Policing Act, one of the federal legislation acts that has not been passed, like the Voting Rights Act, like the Build Back Better Act. But the significance of this and the main sticking point is the whole issue of police liability.
Yeah, I think we have to have some action, whether it is an executive order or whether it is the Senate finally passing the George Floyd Justice and Policing Act. The people who went out to vote for George Floyd during the presidential election and the Senate historic election, the people who went out to vote for Breonna Taylor, for Ahmaud Arbery, for Javier Ambler, the people who had them on their mind and in their hearts when they went in a global pandemic, risking their life to deliver the United States Senate and the presidency to the Democrats, expect there to be action before we deliver another miracle and helping the Democrats in the midterm election maintain power. It is very important that we have to see you doing everything in your power to get this George Floyd Justice and Policing Act passed, whether that is executive order or the passage of the bill by the Senate, because our children are dying. And it is an exigent situation. It is a state of emergency, and we must see action. If not, don't expect action from us to come to the polls. It is a life or death situation when our children leave the house every day, and we need you to feel our pain. We need you to act.
Ben Crump, we want to thank you for being with us. Civil rights attorney, part of the George Floyd family legal team, the Daunte Wright family legal team, the Javier Ambler legal team, and more. Next up, we remember the trailblazing black feminist scholar and activist Bell Hooks, who died this week at the age of 69. Stay with us.
Precious love, take my hand. Lead me on. Let me stand. Lord, Master, I'm so weak. Ooh, I'm worn. Ooh,
Take my hand, precious Laura. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. The trailblazing black feminist scholar and activist Bell Hooks died Wednesday at the age of 69. She was a prolific author who wrote about how a person's race, gender, and social class are interconnected, often referred to the, quote, imperialist white supremacist capitalist patriarchy. Born Gloria Jean Watkins, Bell Hooks wrote more than 40 books, including the 1981 book, Ain't I a Woman? Black Women and Feminism, which took its title from the speech by abolitionist Sojourner Truth. Bell Hooks was a longtime educator, most recently a distinguished professor at Berea College in her home state of Kentucky, which created the Bell Hooks Institute as a center for her writing and teaching. Bell Hooks died at her home in Kentucky, surrounded by family and friends. Her family says her cause of death was end-stage renal failure. We'll talk more about her life and legacy with her close friend of more than 40 years, Beverly Guy Schefthal, former president of National Women's Studies Association and women's studies professor at Spelman. But first, let's hear Bell in her own words, speaking in 2006 at the University of Oregon when she gave the keynote address at the Women of Color Conference.
Committed to the struggle to end domination in all its forms since my teenage years, in midlife I find myself constantly seeking to understand why we have heightened awareness about the suffering caused by exploitation and oppression, both in our nation and in the world. Yet this awareness has not inspired us all to move towards the collective action needed to bring peace, love, and healing. In my 20s and early 30s, I was most obsessed with finding words to explain systems of domination, to critique, and to find a voice to express militant resistance. My voice was at times shrill and piercing, full of the pain, feelings of powerlessness in gender, coupled with awareness of the chokehold dominator culture had on my consciousness. In those days, that voice was often interpreted by the status quo as angry, and more often than not, too angry to be worthy of being listened to or heard. Allies in struggle, liberal and progressive, were often eager and still are to portray people of color coming to voice as always and only angry. For radical white folks who had not fully unlearned their racialized sexism, their projected image of an angry black woman letting it all hang out was often superimposed over the reality of voices that were simply boldly speaking truth to power. Ellen Herman, who teaches here in the history department, was the editor of my very first book, Ain't I a Woman, Black Women and Feminism. And I remember the day that she called me and said, you know, we really want to publish your book, but we feel that it's so angry. And I said, well, Ellen, you know, I can't accept that. It wasn't anger that I was feeling when I wrote this book. It was the keenness of insight. It was the clarity of truth-telling. It was the power of breaking out of the bondage of oppression and exploitation. We have to think about why, when people of color find our voice, white people so often can only hear that voice as an angry voice.
The acclaimed feminist scholar and activist Bell Hooks, speaking in 2006 at the University of Oregon when she gave the keynote address at the Women of Color Conference and read from some of her recent writing. Bell Hooks died Wednesday. She was the author of more than 40 books ranging from essays and poetry to children's books such as Skin Again. In 2000, she published the book All About Love, New Visions, and wrote, quote, "It is essential to our struggle for self-determination that we speak of love. For love is a necessary foundation enabling us to survive the wars, the hardships, the sickness, and the dying with our spirits intact. It is love that allows us to survive whole." For more, we're joined by her dear friend, Beverly Guy Schefthal. She is the former president of National Women's Studies Association, professor of women's studies at Spelman College. First of all, Professor Guy Schefthal, our condolences on the loss of your close friend, Bell Hooks.
Thank you very much, Amy. And I am really happy to be here. And I loved that particular speech that you all quoted from.
Talk about your friend and the icon, the African feminist, African-American feminist trailblazer, Bell Hooks. First, her name. Talk about how she kept it in lowercase and why she chose to take that name, Bell Hooks.
So Bell Hooks chose the name of her great-grandmother, Bell Hooks, because she learned from family and other members of the small rural Hopkinsville community in Kentucky that her great-grandmother was fierce and always talking back. And so rather than attach her name to her books, she wanted to create some distance between me, the author, and the words. And the choice of Bell Hooks, her great-grandmother, which she put in lowercase letters, said to us that it is not me, Gloria Watkins, who is the most important. It's what these words are. And the model of my great-grandmother, Bell Hooks, who stays in my consciousness. And the small letters also captured, I think, Bell Hooks's always transgressive oppositional self. So I'm not going to even use capital letters. I'm not going to use my name. I'm going to use my transgressive great-grandmother's name on those books.
Can you talk about Bell Hooks' life and the message she felt, which was so important to understand?
The first thing I'll say about Bell Hooks is that she was always the teacher. I mean, we know she was a professor at many, many places, Oberlin College, Berea, where she spent her last 20 years as a teacher, as a professor. She had a PhD in English, where she wrote a dissertation on Toni Morrison. But fundamentally, she was a teacher. And by teacher, I meant she believed that her audience was broader than the academy or broader than higher education. And she wanted to reach the largest number of people, regular people, young boys, children that she could. And she wanted to have the broadest impact on the broadest amount of people. And so when I think of Bell Hooks, I think about her primarily as a teacher. And she was very much impacted by teachers. She was very much impacted, for example, by the Buddhist person, Thich Nhat Hanh. And I think that she saw herself in some ways as a person who would sit with young people and community people and students and help them understand this world in which we live, which is full of all kinds of domination. So I see her as a teacher. She was hard-hitting. She was sometimes merciless in her critiques. She was unrelenting. She was courageous. She was in your face, but she was also gentle. And I was just listening to that sort of soft voice, gentle spirit, passionate, and always trying to tell the truth from her perspective.
You know, I got a chance to interview her and asked her, it was to remember Paulo Freire, the great educator who wrote The Pedagogy of the Oppressed, where she also laid out her philosophy of education. This is Bell Hooks.
In our culture, so often people teach beliefs, values, ideas that have no relationship to how they live their lives. And each of the many times that I saw Paulo, I saw him exemplify again and again a unity between theory and praxis. And that has inspired me both as an intellectual and as a teacher to want to have that kind of unity, to believe that and to know that it's not a dream or a fantasy, but that you can teach by being in the world as much as you can by the books you write.
And I wanted to turn to an excerpt from Bell Hooks' 1999 speech at the Los Angeles Public Library. Here she talks about her conception of love and her book Yearning, Race, Gender, and Cultural Politics.
When I go and I talk a little bit about the question of love, people will start saying to me, oh, I hope you're not going to lose that, you know, critical edge, that daring, you know, like angry voice that we had in all the other writings. And I say to them that that's exactly what I think about the question of love, that to talk about love and to talk about the big question of why choose love and why our nation has to choose love again as one of the ethical values driving our daily lives is in fact to be doing that which is courageous and daring and enormously difficult to do, precisely because of the profound trivialization of love in our culture. We might do well to not just problematize our difficulties around race, gender, and other things, but to also then talk about what brings us together. You know, what kinds of yearnings do we share across all of those things? And it seems to me that the desire to love and be loved is one of those yearnings people share, irrespective of class, race, sexual preference, practice, and that it might be interesting for us to theorize in terms of our struggles to end all forms of domination from that place of love.
So that's Bell Hooks talking about her book Yearning, Race, Gender, and Cultural Politics. If you can talk about that, and also her talking about white capitalist, white supremacist capitalist patriarchy, Professor Guy Cheftal.
You know, it might be good to remind all of us that to have black people love themselves, that is a radical act in the U.S. context. And it's not just black women. She wanted little black boys to love themselves. She wanted little black girls with so-called nappy hair to love themselves, which is why she wrote that book about of being nappy. So we might think about love as a sort of innocuous, trivial, non-political project. But she knew that loving ourselves, all people, but particularly people of color and black people in the U.S., to love ourselves is a radical political act. And that's one of the people's favorite books, all about love, because I think we understood that if you don't love yourself, if you don't engage in self-love, you cannot possibly change the world. And so that was an extremely important intervention in terms of her writings. Her constant naming of imperial white supremacist patriarchy, which can also be framed, if we borrow Kimberly Crenshaw's term, intersectionality. Bell didn't use the term intersectionality. She wanted us to hear imperial white supremacist patriarchy. And later she added heteropatriarchy, because she wanted to name what that was. But it is essentially the concept of intersectionality, which goes back to the 19th century black women such as Mariah Stewart and Ida B. Wells. And so she never stopped saying it. Imperial, white supremacist, heteropatriarchy, because she wanted us to hear it over and over and over again so that we could eradicate it.
And as you talked about children loving themselves, particularly black children, she wrote that acclaimed children's book, Skin Again, beautifully illustrated by Chris Rashka. The book reads in part, "The skin I'm in is just a covering. It cannot tell my story. If you want to know who I am, you have to come inside and open your heart way wide." Professor.
Yes. She also, her favorite children's book was B-Boy Buzz, which she talked about a lot. And you have a little more protagonist. And she talked about the fact that the publishers were sort of reluctant to have a little black boy protagonist. But of course, she insisted. in the same way as she described earlier, insisting to those publishers of that very first book that she was not angry. She was committed. And she always, again, insisted, lived the life that she wanted to live, lived it on her own terms. And that was with book publishers, her employers, her family, her partners, and her friends.
Beverly Guy-Sheftall, I want to thank you so much for remembering bell hooks. It's hard to say remembering. She died just this week at the age of 69. Professor Beverly Guy-Sheftall is a professor of women's studies at Spelman College, former president of the National Women's Studies Association. Next up, we hear from Democratic Senator Raphael Warnock. Stay with us.
Black is the color of my true love's hair. Black is the color of my love so fair.
Michelle Indigo-Cello, Black is the Color of My True Love's Hair, with Valerie June, one of bell hooks' favorites. This is Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman, as we end today's show with Democratic Senator Raphael Warnock's powerful speech from the floor of the Senate Tuesday, as he called on the conservative members of the Democratic Party to stop obstructing voting rights legislation. He didn't name Senators Joe Manchin and Sinema, who have come out against doing away with the filibuster in order to allow Democrats to pass the Freedom to Act, Freedom to Vote Act, and the John Lewis Voting Rights Advancement Act.
Conniving methods that were getting in the way of the free exercise of the constitutional right to vote. His rallying cry that day in 1957 was, give us the ballot. And so, Madam President, in light of the conniving methods of voter suppression we have seen enacted into law since the January 6th attack on the Capitol, I come to the floor today to share with the people of Georgia and the American people the message that I shared with my colleagues over the weekend and earlier today during our caucus meeting. I said to my Democratic colleagues over the last several days, number one, unfortunately, the vast majority of our Republican friends have made it clear that they have no intention of trying to work with us to address voter suppression or to protect voting rights. They have embodied by their actions the sentiments of conservative strategist Paul Weyrich, who dared say in 1981, quote, "I don't want everybody to vote." That's what he said. Elections are not won by a majority of people. They never have been from the beginning of our country, and they are not now. As a matter of fact, he went on to say, our leverage in the elections, quite candidly, goes up as the voting populace goes down. Second thing I said to my Democratic colleagues today is that while we cannot let our Republican friends off the hook for not being equitable governing partners, if we are serious about protecting the right to vote that's under assault right now, here's the truth. It will fall to Democrats to do it. And if Democrats alone must raise the debt ceiling, then Democrats alone must raise and repair the ceiling of our democracy. How do we in good conscience justify doing one and not the other? Some of my Democratic colleagues are saying, but what about bipartisanship? Isn't that important? I say, of course it is. But here's the thing we must remember. slavery was bipartisan. Jim Crow segregation was bipartisan. The refusal of women's suffrage was bipartisan. The denial of the basic dignity of members of the LGBTQ community has long been bipartisan. The Three-Fifths Compromise was the creation of a putative national unity at the expense of Black people's basic humanity. So when colleagues in this chamber talk to me about bipartisanship, which I believe in, I just have to ask, at whose expense? Who is being asked to foot the bill for this bipartisanship? And is liberty itself the cost? I submit that that's a price too high and a bridge too far. And so I struggled this weekend. I talked to folk I believe in. Among them, I spoke with Reverend Ambassador Andrew Young, who was with Dr. King until the very end, about this vote. I talked to Ambassador Young and I asked him, what do you think? And he said, I try not to worry, but I'm worried about our country. And then this 89-year-old battle-worn soldier in the nonviolent army of the Lord drew silent on the phone. And then he said to me, tell your colleagues that among your constituents are people who literally laid their lives on the line for the basic right to vote. They lost friends. They lost so much. And so this is a real moral quandary for me, and it makes it difficult for me to cast this vote today. But after many conversations with colleagues, with Georgians, with experts who know the economy, with voting rights advocates and civil rights leaders, I will indeed vote today with anguish. I will vote to raise the debt ceiling. I'm voting yes because I'm thinking about the kids in the Caton Homes housing projects where I grew up in Savannah, Georgia. I'm thinking about the hardworking families pushing to recover from the pressures of this pandemic, those on the margins and those who are least resilient, for whom a collapse of the economy would be catastrophic. And ironically, many of these are the same people who are also being targeted by the voter suppression efforts I mentioned earlier. I'm thinking of them and the people of Georgia as I cast my vote today to raise the debt ceiling. But I'm also thinking about what we need to do to keep our democracy and our economy strong today and for the next generation. Once we handle the debt ceiling, the Senate needs to make voting rights the very next issue we take up. We must do voting rights and we must deal with this issue now. So let me be clear. I'm so proud of what we did with the bipartisan infrastructure bill and the major economic investments we're putting finishing touches on that will close the Medicaid coverage gap and deliver historic relief to Georgia farmers and expand broadband access and so much more. But Madam President.
That's Democratic Georgia Senator Raphael Warnock's excerpt of a powerful speech from the floor of the Senate Tuesday, as he called on conservative members of his own party to stop obstructing voting rights legislation. Reverend Warnock is also pastor of the Ebenezer Baptist Church in Atlanta, which was the spiritual home of Dr. Martin Luther King and his father. And that does it for our show. Democracy Now! Is produced with Renee Feltz, Mike Burke, Dina Guzder, Messiah Rhodes, Nermeen Sheikh, Maria Terracena, Tammy Warrenoff, Charina Nadura, Sam Alkoff, Tamari Astudio, John Hamilton, Robbie Karen, Hani Massoud, and Mary Conlon. Our general manager is Julie Crosby. Special thanks to Becca Staley, Paul Powell, Mike DeFilippo, Miguel Nogueira, Hugh Grand, Dennis Moynihan, David Prude, and Dennis McCormick. You can go to democracynow.org for all of our shows, and also check us out on Instagram, on Facebook, on Twitter. I'm Amy Goodman. Remember, wearing a mask is an act of love.
Ici Martin Carly, vulgarisateur scientifique. La vaccination des 5 à 11 ans contre la COVID-19 est commencée. En tant que parent, vous vous demandez peut-être si votre enfant recevra le même vaccin que celui pour adultes. Le vaccin utilisé pour les enfants de moins de 12 ans contient une plus petite quantité d'ARN messager, car le système immunitaire des enfants répond mieux que celui des adultes. Et bien que la dose soit plus petite, le vaccin est tout aussi efficace que chez les adultes.
Pour plus d'informations, rendez-vous sur québec.ca/vaccinjeune. Un message du gouvernement du Québec.
Peinando entre cortina y cortina, los cabellos son de oro y los peines de plata fina. Pero mira cómo beben los peces en el río.